She dressed and climbed painfully down from the wagon. Jim and Buckhut were busy at the horse lines, washing the scratches and small injuries that Drumfire and Trueheart had received in yesterday's battle with the elephant, and feeding them a little of the precious oats and bran moistened with black molasses as a reward for their courage. When he looked up and saw Louisa struggling down from her wagon, Jim exclaimed with alarm and ran to her. "You should keep to your bed. What are you doing here?" "I am going to see to breakfast." "What madness is this? Zama can do without your instruction for a day. You must rest." "Do not treat me like a child," she told him. But the reprimand lacked fire, and she smiled at him as she limped to the cooking fire. He did not argue. It was a gorgeous morning, bright and cool, and this put them both in a sunny mood. They ate under the trees to the sound of birdsong from the branches above them, and the meal became a small celebration of the previous day's events. With animation they discussed every detail of the hunt and relived all the excitement and terror, but neither mentioned the events of the night, although they were uppermost in their minds. "Now I must go back to the carcass to remove the tusks. It's not a task I can leave to others. A careless slip of the axe will damage the ivory irrevocably," he told her, as he mopped his plate with a piece of unleavened pot bread. "I'll rest Drumfire today. He worked hard yesterday, and I'll take Crow. Trueheart will stay in camp, for she's as lame as you are." "Then I shall ride Stag," she said. "It will not take me long to don my boots." Stag was a strong but gentle gelding they had taken from Colonel Caser. "You should stay in camp to recuperate fully." "I must go with you to retrieve my rifle, which I dropped into thorn thickets." "That's a feeble pretext. I can do that for you." "You do not truly believe that I shall not attend the removal of the tusks for which we risked our very lives?" He opened his mouth to protest, but saw from her expression that it would be a wasted effort. "I shall tell Buckhut to saddle Stag." There were two traditional methods of withdrawing the tusks. The carcass could be left to decompose, and when the cartilage that held the tusks in their sockets had softened and disintegrated, they could be pulled forcibly from the skull. This was a lengthy and malodorous business, and Jim was impatient to see his trophies revealed in all their magnificence. So was Louisa. When they rode back, they found a canopy of circling carrion birds darkening the sky above the body of the dead bull. In this vast assembly there were every species of vulture and eagle, as well as the undertaker storks with their monstrous beaks and bald pink heads, which seemed to have been parboiled. The branches of the trees around the dead bull groaned under the weight of this feathered horde. As Jim and Louisa rode up to the carcass, packs of hyena slunk away, and little red jackals peered at them from the cover of the thorn bushes with pricked ears and bright eyes. These scavengers had picked out the eyes of the bull and burrowed in through his anus, but they had not been able to tear open the tough grey hide to reach the flesh. Where the vultures had perched upon the carcass, their excrement had left white stains down its sides. Jim felt a sense of outrage at this desecration of such a noble beast. Angrily he drew his rifle from its sheath and fired at one of the black vultures on the top branches of the nearest tree. Struck squarely by the leaden ball, the hideous bird came tumbling down in a welter of feathers and flapping wings. The rest of the roosting flock rose and climbed to join their peers in the sky above. When Louisa retrieved her rifle, she found that the woodwork was only lightly scratched. She came back and selected a vantage point in the shade. Seated on a saddle blanket, she sketched the proceedings and made notes in the margins of the page. Jim's first task was to sever the bull's immense head from the neck. This had to be done to make it easier to handle. It would have taken 50 men or more to roll the massive carcass from one side to the other. As it was, the decapitation took half the morning. Stripped to the waist, the men were sweating in the noonday sun before it was accomplished. Then came the painstaking work of removing the skin and chipping away the bone from around the roots of the tusks, with meticulous axe strokes. Jim, Buckhut, and Zama took turns, not trusting the clumsy touch of the wagon drivers and servants on the precious ivory. First one and then the other tusk was lifted out of its bony canal and laid upon a mattress of cut grass. With quick strokes of her brush, Louisa recorded the moment when Jim stooped over the tusks and, with the point of his knife, freed the long, cone-shaped nerve from the hollow butt end of each one. They slithered out, white and glutinous as jelly. They wrapped the tusks in cushions of cut grass, loaded them onto the backs of the pack horses, and bore them back to the wagons in triumph. Jim unpacked the scale his father had given him for this purpose and suspended it from the branch of a tree. Then, surrounded by everyone, he weighed the tusks one at a time. The right-hand shaft of ivory, the bull's working tusk, was more worn and weighed 143 pounds. The larger tusk weighed 150 pounds precisely. Both were stained brown by vegetable juices where they had been exposed, but the butts were a lovely cream colour, glossy as precious porcelain where they had been protected in the sheath of bone and cartilage. In all the hundreds of traded tusks I've seen pass through the go-down at High Weald, I have never seen one larger, he told Louisa proudly. They sat late beside the campfire that night, for there seemed so much still to say. Bakat Zama and the other servants had all rolled themselves in their blankets and were sleeping beside their fires when Jim walked Louisa back to her wagon. Afterwards he lay on his own bed, naked in the balmy night. As he drifted off, he listened to the weird sobbing and laughter of the hyena patrolling the outskirts of the camp, attracted by the scent of the raw elephant meat curing on the smoking racks. His last thought was to wonder if Smallboy and the other drivers had placed the leather ropes and tackle of the wagon harness out of reach of those scavengers. With their formidable jaws, the hyena could chew and swallow the toughest tanned leather as easily as he could devour a luscious oyster. But he knew that the safety and condition of the wagon harness was always Smallboy's first concern, and he let himself drop into a sound sleep. He woke suddenly, aware that the wagon had rocked lightly under him. His first thought was a continuation of the last. Perhaps a hyena was raiding the camp. He sat up and reached for the loaded musket that always lay beside his bed, but before his hand could fall upon the stock, he froze and stared towards the afterclap. The moon still lacked 2 nights of full, and he could tell by its angle that it must be after midnight. Its light threw a soft glow through the canvas curtain of the afterclap. Louisa was silhouetted against it, an ethereal fairy figure. He could not see her face, for it was in shadow, but her hair came down in a pale cascade around her shoulders. She took a hesitant pace towards his bed. Then she stopped again. He could see by the way in which she held her head that she was shy or afraid, maybe both. "Louisa, what ails you?" "I could not sleep," she whispered. "Is there anything I can do?" She did not reply at once, but instead she came forward slowly and lay down at his side. "Please, Jim, be kind to me. Be patient with me." They lay in silence, without touching, their bodies rigid. Neither knew what to do next. Louisa broke the silence. "Speak to me, Jim. Do you want me to go back to my own wagon?" It irked her that he, who was usually so bold, was timid now. "No! Oh, please, no!" he blurted out. "Then speak to me. I'm not sure what you want me to say, but I will tell you all that is in my mind and heart," he said. He thought for a while, and his voice sank to a whisper. "When first I saw you on the deck of the ship, it seemed that I had been waiting all my life for that moment." She sighed softly, and he felt her relax beside him, like a cat spreading herself out in the warmth of the sun. Encouraged, he went on. "I have often thought, when I watch my father and mother together, that for every man born, God fashions a woman." "Adam's rib," she murmured. "I believe that you are my rib," he said. "I cannot find happiness and fulfillment without you. Go on, Jim. Please don't stop. I believe that all the terrible things that happened to you before we met, and all the hardships and dangers we have endured since then, have had but one purpose. That is to test and temper us like steel in the furnace." "I had not thought of that," she said. "But now I see it is true. He reached out and touched her hand. It seemed to him that a spark passed between their fingertips, like the crackling discharge of gunpowder in the pan. She jerked away her hand. He sensed that their moment, although close, had not yet arrived. He took back his own hand, and she relaxed again. His Uncle Dorian had once given him a filly that no one else could break to the bit and saddle. It had been very much like this, weeks and months of slow progress, of advance and retreat, but in the end she had become his, as beautiful and wondrous a creature as it was possible to imagine. He had called her Windsong, and had held her head as she died of the horse sickness. On an inspiration he told Louisa about Windsong, how he had loved her, and how she had died. She lay beside him in the darkness and listened, captivated. When he came to the end of the story, she wept like a child. But they were good tears, not the bitter, hurting tears that had so often gone before. Then she slept at last, still lying beside him, still not quite touching. He listened to her gentle breathing, and at last slept also.